Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Cesar Chavez founded a labor union, launched a movement, and inspired a generation. In her new book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Miriam Powell offers a comprehensive biography of Chavez. He emerges here as a visionary figure with tragic flaws, a brilliant strategist who sometimes stumbled, and a canny streetwise organizer whose pragmatism was often at odds with his elusive, soaring dreams. Miriam Powell will be in our region tonight and tomorrow. Tonight at Skidmore College, tomorrow night in Troy at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. We'll talk to her about that in just a moment. In the meantime, we welcome Miriam Powell to the roundtable this morning. Miriam, thank you very much for being with us once again. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Very nice to have you back on the program. What brought you to want to look in this way at this man and his accomplishments?
You know, Joe, it's really, I did this because there was no biography of him. And it grew out of other work that I had done. I'm actually have now spent almost a decade writing about farm workers and the United Farm Workers Union and Cesar Chavez. And my first book was about the movement, not so he was an important part of it, but he was not the central figure. And when I finished that, people began to say, you know, you really should write a biography because there is none. And, I knew that people didn't really know who Cesar Chavez was anymore unless they're of a certain age and they boycotted grapes. But even I kind of underestimated the degree to which he's really faded from our sort of collective memories. And so this was my effort in some ways to restore him to the place in history that I think he really deserves.
You make the point that even President Obama, in his campaign 15 years after his death, that the president was using the slogan, "Yes, we can," as a way of winning the White House. So obviously the presence is very much there at the forefront. What was it about Chavez that you think not only was able to launch that movement and inspire a generation, but still be relevant today?
You know, I think his relevance today, I mean, he should be even more relevant today than he is, because the lessons that sort of he, some of the strategies that he pioneered and his example in terms of the strength of basic community organizing, and that's where Si Se Puede comes from, and that's why Obama adopted it in his first campaign, because of that focus that Obama, as a community organizer, had on grassroots organizing. So he remains kind of an iconic figure, but in its very nebulous way. There was a movie that came out last year where Diego Luna made the movie and premiered it in Washington on the Capitol. The Labor Secretary Thomas Perez said, you know, people know he had something to do with farm workers, but they can't get to the next sentence. And, you know, those next sentences are quite remarkable, because the way that he was able to form strategic alliances and to pioneer tactics like the Great Boycott enabled him to take farm workers in California, who were basically the poorest of the poor, and show them that they had the power to overcome the strongest industry in the state and to force growers to sign contracts with, you know, their poorest workers. So that's where his legacy, I think, resonates among those who do remember it, and should be a really interesting example for anybody sort of interested in progressive causes and social justice fights today.
You talk in the book about his profound humanity. Give us a sense of that and why it was so important in his success.
He was this charismatic leader in a very untraditionally charismatic way, at a time when there were the Kennedys and King and so forth. I mean, that was the height of Chavez's fame to some degree. And yet he was this, you know, short, unprepossessing, not particularly good public speaker, didn't like public speaking. And that gave him sort of an enormous power that he used, because for farm workers, they would look at him and say, he's one of us. He's like us. He understands. So that allowed him to sort of have a credibility and a strength among workers who he was trying to convince to sort of overcome their fear of joining this organization and jeopardizing their precarious livelihood. And then at the same time, when I say that his humanity is important, I also mean that it's important for us to understand him as a heroic figure who was, you know, not a saint and not a sort of, not the nice smiling face on the postage stamp, but a very human, mortal person with strengths and weaknesses. And there's been a real reluctance until recently to write about him in any kind of scholarly way or in any kind of, in terms of his complexity, because there was this sense of, oh, if we say anything critical about Cesar Chavez, you're tarnishing the preeminent Latino figure of our times. And I think that's it really does him a disservice, and it sort of does people a disservice in to make an assumption that people are not going to understand that heroes are very human and have foibles and flaws just like the rest of us.
So with his place in history secure, as you say in the book, what is it about the legend, and you make this point in the book, about this mythology, that it is important to know certain aspects? And I'm curious as to, when you speak, what are the things that you want people to know about this man that are so important to put him in a context?
I think that one of the important things about him to understand is how he struggled, as did people around him and as did the entire movement for a period of time, with its own success in some sense. Because sometimes he gets described as a labor leader, which always makes me cringe a little bit, because he was an anti-labor union leader, practically. I mean, he had disdain for the traditional labor movement, and he believed very much in the importance of the social movement and in instilling in workers an understanding of the belief of the importance of sacrifice. You know, for him, middle class was a very derogatory term. And so part of what's fascinating about him and what I want people to come away with and to understand is, you know, here's a man he's so full of contradictions in a very interesting way. I mean, he creates his own mythology, and yet he saves the documentation, meticulously saves documents and tapes and so forth that allow us years later as historians to go back and show how he bent the story in order to use it to organize. And he is a labor leader who wants to, you know, have a successful union and yet wants his members to not aspire to be middle class. And all of those are the things that sort of, I think, resonate with people who, I mean, he wants to have a democracy, but he doesn't really want to have a democracy because he wants to maintain control. And those are all issues, I think, that resonate for people who are looking to affect change in any way.
Miriam Powell is our guest. She is the author of the book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez. She'll be in our region tonight and tomorrow. Again, the title of the book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, by Miriam Powell. When it comes to the actual change, you talk about in the book of how this leadership style that he had devolved into a cult of personality. And yeah. I'm curious as to how that happened and ultimately the consequences it had for the union that he brought about.
You know, in 1962, he moves to Delano, California. He's got 8 kids. He has sort of, you know, almost no money, with this dream of forming a labor union for farm workers who are not protected by, you know, any health, safety, labor laws. 1965, the strike starts. No one knows who he is. 1969, he's on the cover of Time magazine. And, you know, I always give those dates because I think that to understand sort of the cult of personality is also important to think about that meteoric rise and what that does to you. And there's probably the most famous picture of him is with Bobby Kennedy breaking his first lengthy fast in 1968, and that just catapults him into this world that on some level he was, you know, ill-prepared for, someone who had been going around and meeting with farm workers in groups of two and three and five and forming this organization in a very one-on-one way. And there does become a cult of personality, and he embraces that, I think, partly for strategic reasons, because it is an organizing tool, and partly because it's, you know, that's what charismatic leaders do. And he's very determined to maintain control of the farm workers union, and he does that really at the expense of creating a viable, sustained labor union for farm workers. So, you know, in the late 1970s, they achieve this remarkable victory legislatively. There's a law in California that allows farm workers to have a petition for elections and choose their own union, which to this day, California is the only state that has that. And there are, you know, hundreds of elections, and then suddenly there's this bureaucracy, and there are contracts, and there are members who want, you know, are paying dues and expect things in a transactional relationship. And that is not, that's not what he wants. What is important to him is the idea of a social movement. And so on the tape recordings, which I listened to hundreds of hours of tapes that he made of the executive board meetings of the UFW, there are these anguished conversations. Are we a movement? Are we a union? Can we be both? And to the people around him who have been struggling for all these years to get to exactly the point they're at, the answer seems to be clear that it's sort of, well, we want to have a movement element, but if we have to choose, we've been fighting to create a union. And he says, no, you know, you can do that, but I'll leave. And, you know, that thread is very hollow because he is the union at that point. I mean, there actually is a union holiday called Founders Day, which is Cesar Chavez's birthday. And it's that in 1977, the UFW adopts his birthday as Founders Day because it is allegedly, although not exactly, really in truth, the day he decided to found the United Farm Workers. And so, you know, that gives you a sense of the degree to which he had become, almost a cult-like following.
And what impact did the misuses of power that you write about in the book, what impact did they have on his legacy, but also on the people around him and the strength of the work that they were doing?
Well, it drove a lot of the people around him out of the union. I mean, either voluntarily or forcibly. There is this period in the late 1970s going into the early 1980s where this kind of remarkable coalition of organizers who had, you know, contributed to this, getting the union to the point where it was, all either leave or are driven out because it becomes clear that this is not his priority. And, you know, he sees this coming way ahead. I mean, he's very visionary. And, you know, he says in 1965 when the grape strike starts, he says in an interview, we have to find a cross between being a movement and a union. We have to create something new. And he's not the first charismatic leader to be able to create something that he was then, you know, not the right person to run. And yet he could not relinquish control to people who could have run it effectively or more effectively. So essentially by the 1980s, the UFW is in decline. In their peak membership was in 1970. They had a burst in the late 1970s when the law was passed. And then in the 1980s, he has driven out not only the top organizers, but also the farm worker leadership that developed. I mean, there are very strong leaders who come out of the fields and who believe him when he says, this is going to be your union and you're going to run it. And, you know, really, he had no intention of relinquishing control to that degree. So by the 1980s, the UFW is essentially, you know, not a force in the field. The contracts dwindle. They begin to blame Republicans. To this day, the UFW says it's really not our fault. It's because we had hostile political climates. And yet, Cesar Chavez achieved his greatest victories when Ronald Reagan was the governor of California and Richard Nixon was the president of the United States. So, you know, adverse political conditions did not hurt them when they were really operating at their peak. So the union just falls into decline, and his legacy, you know, becomes more important in the cities than in the fields. Because in the last decade of his life, in the, you know, between 83 and 93 when he died, he becomes, somewhat ironically, you know, the figure, the face of Chicano power, because, and of the Chicano movement, which was a movement that he really wanted nothing to do with in his fighting years in the Union. But he becomes almost an elder statesman. He goes and he travels around to colleges. He gives a lot of speeches. And he gives a speech in 1984. It's a famous speech at the Commonwealth Club of California, where he gives what in essence is almost a eulogy for his own union, because he says, whatever, it doesn't matter anymore what the union does or doesn't achieve, because what we have shown, this model that if the farm workers could do it, anyone can do it, is now resonating particularly among Hispanics in the cities. And he was right. And so, you know, I think that is partly his legacy, and his legacy is also the generation of organizers and activists who learned from him and learned from being in the UFW and went on and, you know, have been organizing in all sorts of social justice fields to this day and have trained another generation now of organizers. So many of his lessons and his legacy is sort of is everywhere except in the field in some way.
When you come to the region this evening at Skidmore and in Troy tomorrow night, this is a return home. You started at the Times Union, right?
I did. My first job was at the Albany Times Union. I covered the town of Colony. It was a great competitive beat at that time. And then I was also in Albany for 3 years as the bureau chief for Newsday in covering the first Governor Cuomo. when Andrew Cuomo was a dollar a year assistant to his father. So I have lots of good memories of Albany and ties there.
Miriam Powell is our guest. She is the author of the new book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, which is now out in paperback from Bloomsbury Press. When it comes to your speaking about Cesar Chavez and talking about the book and the accomplishments, what do you find in the Q&As that most people want to know, that people are curious about, especially when you talk to groups like the Sanctuary for Independent Media, what people want to know about him in reference to other grassroots movements?
So, I mean, a lot of the things that people want to know, particularly people who were involved in the struggle to some degree or in the boycott and so on, is what happened. You know, they people don't really know what happened to the UFW, what happened to him in the latter years. I get a lot of questions about that. People want to know what happened to Dolores Huerta. Sometimes people who have heard about this ask about Synanon and his relationship with a man named Chuck Dietrich, who was the head of Synanon, which was a drug rehab program morphed into a cult, which is a sort of a whole interesting chapter and very destructive one in the union. They ask about his kids sometimes, what happened to them.
And there are many aspects to the story, of course. And in putting it together, what was the valuable tool? I know you did a ton of interviews and an awful lot of documents. Was there one source that was invaluable?
I think that the tape recordings would be the thing I would immediately come to mind. You know, between the late 60s and the early 1980s, he taped not everything, but he taped all of the executive board meetings of the union. He taped lessons that he gave, conferences for farm workers, and he did it with this very deliberate, you know, he would sometimes say, we're going to tell stories into the tape recorder now for history. And I don't think people around him took it all that seriously. Sometimes when the lawyers objected, you know, sort of said, why are you keeping these? He said, oh, we don't really keep them. We just do the minutes and then we record over them. but it was a very conscious and deliberate attempt on his part to capture history in an utterly unvarnished way. Some of the fights and the screaming matches and the language on the tapes is, you know, it's just, it, I mean, again, it, it's also very human. He tells jokes, he throws fits, he gives really interesting philosophical explanations. So for me, that was, you know, it's like being a fly on the wall. I mean, it's sort of, as a historian, you give up what you have as a journalist, which is seeing things unfold in front of you and having that, you know, you're writing about what you're seeing happen. But as a historian, you have access to this, you know, to listening to conversations that you never would have done. So for me, that was an invaluable window into who he was and what he said, and also enabled me to use actual dialogue in writing the book. And so I think the tapes really were a tremendous asset.
You do have a chapter in the book called From Dream to Nightmare. At what point did the nightmare begin for him?
Oh, that's a good question. I think this is not what the chapter deals with, but in 1973, when the UFW became an official union under the AFL-CIO, not just an organizing committee, it's also a tape with a, there's a whole separate set of tapes that were done by a man who was sort of the authorized biographer in the early 1970s. And Chavez turns to this guy and says, you know, essentially, now the seeds have been sown. And from now on, I'm going to have to get rid of my strongest people, because that's what happens when you're a leader. If you don't get rid of the strongest people, they will come after you. And I hate it, and I hate doing it, but it has to be done. So on some level, I think, you know, at the very moment of creation at the Constitutional Convention of the UFW in 1973, he's sitting there saying, you know, now I'm going to have to take these actions that I really don't want to take, but it's the only way that I can survive and maintain control. So I think that's kind of the beginning of it in a sense, and no one sees that. I mean, no one except him understands that going in that institutional direction is so difficult for him, and that he views it as something that is going to be at odds with his somewhat elusive and never very well articulated dreams of a poor people's movement and union.
And in that chapter, you do talk about there's a point where this is like in the late 1970s, 1979 or so, where he's doing this, but you do get a sense of a weariness, don't you? Of just, he's just tired, and
yep,
and a sense of, all right, there seems to be great enthusiasm around him, but he is tiring.
I think that's absolutely right. And that chapter refers to this strike in 1979, which is this galvanizing moment for the leadership that has come out of the field. There are these strong lettuce workers who are learning how to really organize and run the strike, and, you know, it's their moment, and that is, you know, just the weariness is exactly right. I mean, he's looking at that and saying, this is not, you know, this is not what I want. Now I'm going to have to get rid of these people too. I mean, even in 1969, there's a tape where he says, you know, I'm going to have to pull a Stalin in order to get people in line, essentially. And so by 79, a decade later, yeah, I think there is a weariness. And I also think that he, the passage of the law in 1975 would, you know, an enormous victory. And the law to this day is an incredibly strong pro-labor law, and also stands as an important piece of his legacy. He doesn't really want the law. He wants to be, he loves being what he calls the nonviolent Viet Cong. And he talks about running a union and sort of the, you know, negotiating contracts and administering them and all of that work as being non-missionary work. And so I think by 79, he really sees very, very clearly that in some way, the more successful the union is, the more unhappy he is.
Miriam Powell is the author of the book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, which is now out in paperback from Bloomsbury. She's going to be in our region tonight at Skidmore College at the Emerson Auditorium in Palo Mountain Hall at 6 p.m. You can find out more information about that event by going to skidmore.edu, skidmore.edu. She will also be speaking in Troy tomorrow night at the Sanctuary for Independent Media at 7 p.m., and you can find out more information about that event by going to mediasanctuary.org, mediasanctuary.org, or you can go to Miriam's website, which is Miriam Powell, P-A-W-E-L, miriampowell.com, for a complete list of all her events. Miriam Powell, thank you very much for spending time with us. It'll be great to have you back in the region, and I appreciate the time you spent with us this morning.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Miriam Powell's book is The Crusades of Cesar Chavez. It is published by Bloomsbury. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.